Welcome to the Law of Attraction Radio Network's Quantum Leap Book Club. Our regular host, Parisha, is traveling and teaching today. So today will be presented by the co-hosts, including myself, Geraldine Dalby-Ball. I'm an environmental biologist from Sydney, Australia. We have Trina Cooper, who's a lifelong entrepreneur from Denver, Colorado. Also coming to us from Frankfurt, Germany, Rosemary Heyer, an English teacher who specializes in working with children. We have Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer, a naturopathy and also registered nurse. And also from Australia, Marianne Love, a psychologist based in Melbourne. And today we are working with bringing you news that you may not find in the ordinary places. And I'd love to hand over first to Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer.
Hello, great to be here today. So the newspaper that I'm going to quote from here today is called Mind and Body, the Epoch Times. And it's a natural health newspaper that comes out, I believe, twice a month. I had not been exposed to it, but I was waiting in a waiting room for a friend who was seeing Jack Miller, one of the naturopaths in our area. And here it was in front of me. So I was very interested in the particular topic. I know that we, most people, I would think maybe all people, are aware that when they're near water, oceans, lakes, rivers, streams, whatever, sometimes swimming pools could have the same effect, they feel good. So the scientists have actually done research, and some of these effects are kind of, I guess we could call them no-brainers, that we know, we've experienced them, but some of them were additional to that. So I'm just going to share in about 3 minutes what I got out of this article that was from the newspaper Mind and Body. So some of the research they've done is on the effects for your health when you live in an environment that has water. And one study actually surveyed 18,000 people in 18 countries. So this was fairly thorough. And the report concluded near water helps promote mental and physical well-being. Well, that's kind of a large umbrella. Other research has documented that people who live near water actually, and this amazed me, experience an increase in lifespan. As well, there is, because due to the sound of the moving water, the mental health improves too, compared, and this is what the research showed, people living near water compared to people not living near water, they actually had increased lifespan and better mental health. So some of the other therapeutic benefits are due to the sound of moving water. And these days there's quite a lot of research around the value of what sound or the effects of what sound has in our lives, positive and sometimes negative. So the positive effects of moving water for us, and examples would be listening to the rain falling on the rooftop, a babbling brook. I just really like that phrase. Waves splashing against the shore. These are all peaceful sounds. And don't we all yearn for that kind of environment? So to deal with times of difficulty falling asleep, a suggestion is to listen to a recording of a gentle rainstorm or waves on a beach or a mountain stream coming down over the rocks. The sound of water is soothing and produces a sense of calm. And the word calm all by itself can give you a positive effect, just feeling what calm feels like. And people generally welcome any physical activity around water, such as walking along a lake shore or seashore, kayaking, swimming, canoeing, paddling, and many, many more. Water inspires people to move their bodies. And we do live at a time when people are in front of computers and very often are not moving their physical body in a way that allows good function. So when people are near water, they're more inspired to get outdoors, to enjoy the privilege and the precious moments that they can spend there. With water activity, yes, the emotional benefits have been proven to help veterans with post-traumatic stress. Water is restorative, and in an urban area, a fountain, or a wonderful example are the canals in Venice, enhance the landscape and the quality of life for the people living in such a place. The beauty of water in any shape or size, a pond, a river, a waterfall, ocean, fountain, all these are attractive features which make you feel better. Taking a walk along a shore is a very popular activity. Some more facts about water that you may be well aware of already. It is considered the elixir and source of life for a good reason. Water covers 70% of the Earth's surface, and I don't know that I was aware it was that big a percentage. It makes up 70% of our physical body and heart, and 85% of our brains. Obviously, we have a deep biological connection with water. So, if you cannot be physically present near water, it has been proven that images and photos of water also calm your emotions. And then showers can improve your mood and often boost creativity. Some amazing ideas come to people when they're in the shower. So listening to the sound of moving water is meditative and puts you in the present moment. To live in the now is a goal that we all can achieve and go for. So that is what I'm sharing from this wonderful newspaper that I had not been exposed to, called Mind and Body, the Epoch Times.
Fantastic, and I'm sure people will really relate to water because we all have access to it in some way, which is fantastic. We appreciate that, Joyce. And yes, over to Trina.
There we go. Yeah, for me, what came up this week that I really wanted to chat a little bit about, and hopefully a little bit about later too, this whole idea of portals in the earth and places where we actually can connect into other dimensions or other fields and what goes on. Well, in the book last week, we had talked about the portals in Yosemite. Well, there's a place in Utah, which is now being called Skinwalker Ranch. It was the Sherman Ranch. And there is actually books on this. There's actually a show on this now. But there has been paranormal, UFO, unidentified activities. This ranch is in Unitah County, Utah, and which is kind of bordering a Ute Indian reservation. It's up in the northwestern corner, I believe, of the state. And they've had sightings of unidentified flying objects, orbs. They've had cattle mutilations. They've had large animals reported with piercing red eyes. And what I found most interesting is that there are these very destructive or interfering magnetic fields and vibrations that come from the area that people have not been able to explain. Now, over the years, people have been looking at these for 50 years, and there have been very renowned investigators that have been out there, including a former colonel that had gone out and done some studies. And he's actually Army Colonel John B. Alexander, looking for hard data. And he's one of the people who came forward and says, I truly believe there's a portal on this land. Other authors have written, like George Knapp, who's a very well-known investigative reporter. And the National Institute for Discovery Science has also conducted studies out there. right now they have a team of scientists and experts that are conducting a lot of scientific experiments, and especially trying to hone in on these vibrational frequencies that are actually, and we read this in the book, that if you're not ready for it, it can actually create some issues in the human body. And there are people that live close by that are actually experiencing issues with their human body when they're recording these spikes in the electromagnetic field. So if you're really interested in portals or inner earth activity or UFO activities or dimensional shifts, there are stories like this out there that you can track. And this one again is called Skinwalker Ranch, taken from the Navajo name Skinwalker, which really represented a disgruntled shaman. So it's pretty interesting and exciting. And something, if you're interested in it, dive into the portals and dimensions.
That's a great suggestion to dive in. That's wonderful, Trina. Yes, and appreciate you giving that further information. People can read up on it as well. And I'd like to hand over to Marianne Love, currently in Sydney, Australia.
Yes, I am in the beautiful Sydney, Australia. Now, thanks everyone for sharing. It's really interesting. I love these different topics. It takes us on some great journeys. And what I was exploring this week is, how do you regrow limbs? So we all know, like, salamanders can regrow limbs, fetuses can obviously grow limbs. And one recent scientist has actually found a way to regrow a limb. So what happened was, his brother was using some equipment. He was actually pointing at an airplane, and as he was doing that, he was an engineer. And he actually put his finger in the engine. He chopped half of it off, the poor guy. And his brother happened to be in research around limb regeneration and sent him this interesting white powder and just told him to put it on the wound, wrap it up, put it on the wound, and then every week just keep reapplying this mysterious white powder until eventually the limb, the finger, fully regenerated back. And they showed it on YouTube. You can look it up, back to its whole finger. And what they've been discovering with that is that his brother, who was doing the research, had found that between the cells, they call it a sort of, there's a soup of information going on in between the cells. And it's that information that actually instructs the regeneration and healing within the body. And what they found in the bladder of pigs is that this extracellular matrix, that they call it, is capable of full regeneration. So what he did is actually send him some of that dried material, matrix material, sorry, from the pig, and sent that to his brother. And it's actually able to regrow limbs, regrow fingers, and they're still researching whether you can regrow whole body parts. And there is more research around that. And I'll talk more about that in the next round. But I found it really interesting that, you know, what modern science is now capable of. You know, we can regrow organs and all sorts of things. So that's what I wanted to share today.
That's so interesting. And as we can see, that as we look, there are so many solutions for any problem that we have, so-called problem, any situation that we have, there are new ways of creating outcomes. So I appreciate that one. And Rosemary Heyer in Frankfurt, Germany.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it sounds interesting, all this different kind of variety of topics, and I'm going to bring in a completely different one. Have you ever heard about the open label placebo effect? Well, you might have heard about the placebo effect. I mean, this is when symptoms are improving without any active medical treatment. I mean, usually the patient receives a sugar pill or some kind of injection or an action, but that appear like a medical treatment, but it is not. There's actually nothing done. And many clinical studies have shown, for example, symptoms like pain or fatigue, depression can be significantly reduced with placebo effects. And actually in the UK, 77% of generic practitioners are using placebos regularly. So, and they often, of course, don't tell their patient that they're using it. And it seems to become a more common and really low cost treatment. However, they were thinking, they had some ethical concerns because actually they are lying to the patient. I mean, it's called deceptive use of placebo. And so it could jeopardize actually the relationship between the physician and the patient. So they did a study in 1965 where they decided to tell the patient that he would get a sugar pill. And surprisingly, there was also a reduction of symptoms. And then in 2008, they finally called it OLP, open label placebo, and a placebo effect without deception. And then they have done many more clinical trials. And the way they do it is they actually tell the patient, you will receive a placebo pill. This might help. And it is an inert pill. And alone that word already has a psychological effect, as we can guess. And I got this from a German team who published a review of many studies in February 2021. And they are stating actually that OLP, open label placebo effect, might be more effective than a deceptive placebo effect. From allergies to cancer fatigue to pain reduction, menopause, hot flashes, all kinds of things have been reduced by that kind of treatment. And some of us know Dr. Jody Spencer, and in his book, You Are the Placebo, he actually says that you can experience firsthand that you are your own placebo. But I found it really fascinating, and I'd like to discuss it later more, how that could happen, that you knowingly take a sugar pill and your body starts moving to change into healing. That's what I want to share today. Thank you.
Powerful healing potentials. Lovely. And I'd like to invite Mike Delar to come on and share. And Mike's up in Canada. So welcome today.
Hi, and thank you. I hope you can hear me fine. What I'd like to talk about tonight is something a little different. It's what's called the megalithic yard. And I found this very interesting. A survey carried out by a professor, Alexander Thom, and he surveyed 300 European megalithic sites, and he came to the conclusions that the builders had all used the same standard unit of measurement across many, many sites for many, many thousands of years. They used the same common unit of measurement, and that has come to be known as the megalithic yard. Now, what's remarkable is that they have proven statistically that all the different builders at thousands of sites building structures over many generations were able to establish their own rulers to measure this common megalithic yard with uncanny accuracy, you know, statistically unbelievable accuracy. In fact, they can prove that these people didn't copy the measure from one single source, because if they would have, it would have had more variability. So how did they do it? Well, this is where it gets really impressive, and it proves that someone with a very deep understanding of mathematics and very advanced knowledge of terrestrial and celestial geometry and mechanics was behind it. But the absolutely brilliant part about this technique is, while it's based on very advanced concepts and mathematics, it's simple to teach to people with really just a rudimentary knowledge, and it can all be done with a few sticks and some cord. So I thought I would explain to you how this is done. So first of all, you have to understand that in ancient times, people did not divide the circle into 360 degrees. They actually divided it into 366 degrees. And that we believe, or scientists believe, that that may be because there are actually 366 sunrises every year. The calendar is 365.25 days, right? So there are actually 366 sunrises. So the first step you have to do is you go find a nice open flat place where you can see to the horizon over towards the east. You plant a stick in the center of it, and on sunrise on the very first day, you plant a stick direct line between the center stick and the rising sun, but a fairly good distance away. In my head, I'm thinking like the size of a medicine wheel or a, you know, our dance arbor or something. You can use a cord and you measure out the distance from the center. Then at sunrise on the second day, you plant a stick on the direct line between the central stick and the rising sun on the second day. So the distance is exactly the same as what you used the previous day. Now, what happens is the angle formed between those two sticks and the central stick is equal to 1 megalithic degree, okay? So far, basically, we've figured out how to figure out 1 megalithic degree. Here's the really cool part, and I'm gonna really speed it up here to finish quickly, but in order to determine what a megalithic yard is, you watch a star as it moves from one stick to the other. And the time that it takes to do that, you take a piece of cord with a weight at the end and you have it work as a pendulum. And if you can get the right length of cord so that pendulum is exactly 366 oscillations by the time the star moves, you now have a megalithic yard. So that's my little bit of wisdom for the day.
That's so interesting, Mike. And I know people can research more to find out how a lot of those buildings are similar to each other, and now they have some description of how that might be so as well.
Well, the background is that there's a lot of controversy about this after Alexander Thom came out with this theory. There's still a fair bit of controversy, and some people obviously poo-poo the whole thing. But if the technique that I gave you comes from a book called Uriel's Machine, Reconstructing the Disaster Behind Human History. And it's a fascinating book with a lot of brilliant ideas. And it's two English scientists who put this stuff together, just looking at history and said, what we think of history doesn't make sense. Here's how it might have happened. And it's cool.
Fascinating book title too. Yes, indeed. And we have gone to a very diverse range of news. And I'd like to have a different slant here too, in that some recent news coming out in Australia, both in mainstream universities, University of Newcastle, and published in quite a mainstream newspaper, is about a program that's bringing back Indigenous languages. And the lovely title of it is called Marabingai, and it literally means flying breath. And that name came from our main researcher, Ray Kelly. He's sharing that in his early life of listening to his family around the campfire, he heard a lot of the languages. And then at one time, someone asked his great-grandfather, what is that word that he says when he says Marabingai? And he's just talking about the telephone. So that was the literal translation of telephone, flying breath, which makes sense. You know, the information's come to you, all of a sudden it's in the telephone. So the whole program is called Marabinga, and it's an innovative multimedia language program that's actually being delivered online. Due to COVID, it went online, but this is allowing the first core group of students to participate in workshops, discussions, and it's really quite a primary project, which is going to expand out from here. So it's fantastic to see that the local mainstream news and our education facilities are definitely moving in the direction of appreciation of traditional languages. And as Ray says himself, that Indigenous people have an increased sense of identity, connection, and belonging when there is the language. There's also the acknowledgement that every word and every sound is a vibration. And if you've listened to Australian Aboriginal people's languages, noting that there were more than 250 at the count during 1788, when the definite change of the country is waves of people came from other countries, particularly England. And now there is around 120 languages. But that acknowledgement that every sound is a vibration, every vibration has an influence, this then gives us as a whole of humanity, a drive to protect and appreciate traditional languages, because each of them have vibrations and meaning in the locations where they are, where they're native to. So great to see mainstream picking up on the importance and this wonderful project of supporting and teaching a traditional language in Australia. And that brings us around to one news article, but I know that everyone has some more, and we're halfway through our program, so I'd love to have another piece of information from each of our co-hosts, starting with Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer.
Sure. Well, on the same newspaper that I had in my hand while I was waiting, there was an article that caught my attention right away. Natural immunity, health's forgotten ally. Well, with all the controversy throughout the world about the vaccine that people are lining up for, I wanted to read this and see what they had to say. And there was some really good information, but the thing that actually caught my interest was I have developed an allergy, and I've spent 80 years saying, I don't have allergies. And I blow and I sneeze and I cough. So what they suggested in this particular article was a tea that I've never heard of, called a Japanese green tea, and spelt B like Bob, E like elephant, N like Nancy, I, F-U-U-K-I. So Benny Fuki. I'm going to look it up and see if I can get it locally. This tea, apparently, you take it daily, and in about they quoted 11 weeks, there was no more incidents of itchy eyes, runny nose, throat pain, any of the symptoms of the allergies. So for everybody out there that has any experience with allergies, this is something you might want to look at. Ginger has been spoken of forever on the fact that it is a wonderful antihistamine, as well as vitamin C, bee pollen, and the curcumin in turmeric. So we don't have to blow and cough and sneeze. We have lots of options, and these are just a few that have to be covered in this book, in this newspaper, Mind and Body, the Epoch Times.
Wonderful. Let's say goodbye to blowing and sneezing and coughing. We appreciate that, Joyce. And Trina in Denver, Colorado.
Hi, I'm going back to the UFO topic again. And, you know, right now we're really in a time of disclosure. We hear that from a lot of places, that different countries are actually beginning to say, yeah, this is true. The Vatican, so many other places are beginning to admit the fact that they've got some kind of scientific proof, pictures, whatever it is. And one of the things that's happening right now, which is kind of cool, I just heard this term about this last week, and I had to go some digging for it. And it's called a UAP instead of a UFO. And I hadn't heard that term before. I heard it on a show and I went, what's that all about? Well, UFOs stand for unidentified flying objects. A lot of the experts and scientists feel that this is being kind of poo-pooed or not taken seriously. People think it's a joke. So they now come up with a new term called UAP, which stands for the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. And many of the experts feel like this is going to be a much more professional label. It doesn't have the same connotation as aliens and some of the scary things or the movies that have come out. And they're really wanting to start looking at this seriously. So it's supposed to have less stigma attached to it and maybe be a little more acceptable to the common everyday person. So what's also very interesting with this is that the United States Office of Naval Intelligence has now created an unidentified aerial phenomenal task force called the UAPTF. And so they are actually beginning to use the term, and it's coming up in so many other places that I think I wanted to make sure that people were really clear that when they hear people talk about UFO and UAP in the same discussion, they're really kind of switching from that unidentified flying object topic to the unidentified aerial phenomenon.
Absolutely. I think that's also, as you mentioned, getting closer to letting people know that it's not just unidentified. We're starting to be a lot more aware of our skies and our potential visitors as well. I appreciate that, Trina. And handing over now to Marianne.
Hi, this is fun. We're going from water to UFOs to back to healing. It's great. And I guess because I'm a psychologist, I obviously have an interest in healing and mental health. So one of the things I wanted to share was a little bit about neurofeedback. And if people don't know about that, it's basically using equipment to give the brain feedback. So it's measuring the electrical charge coming off the brain and using programs like pretty much like games to train and teach the brain to develop and be rewarded for new brainwave patterns. And so what they've done is taken children with ADHD and they compared the effect of using brain training, using neurofeedback with them taking medication and had a look at like 500 children over a 6-month period and to see the effects. And what they found was neurofeedback actually had a similar effect, as in efficiency, as did medication, except the benefit of neurofeedback is that it didn't have to keep taking medication, whereas once you're on medication, you pretty much have to continue on it in order to get the benefits from it. And neurofeedback had also little side effects. And after measuring like 12 months later, the effects, the benefits of the neurofeedback were maintained, which really means that these games and just wiring some kids up to some electrical equipment that measured their brainwave activity meant that they actually changed more permanently their brainwave activity so that they could focus and heal from some of the effects of ADHD. I thought I'd get that out there.
I think that is so pertinent and exciting. And for anyone who works with young people, anything that helps them be happy and healthy and who they are is awesome. So appreciate that sharing. And you're right, there is a wonderful diversity. And let's go to Rosemary in Germany to see that diversity continue.
Well, I just want to add something to what Trina said, because I was thinking about preparing for the same subject. And what I've got from mass media is that the report is coming out on June 25th, but it only supposedly covers 120 sightings. And I was recently on a website which showed documentaries from the government, and it showed a huge report from a certain committee. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name. It was a committee which was going through all the reports from the Navy, mostly from everybody in the whole world. And they were saying that there were thousands and thousands of sightings alone in the United States, but also in every country in the world, there were sightings. And also the Navy, there's a Navy member who said that for about 20 years, they were reporting constantly sightings. So again, what we're getting is like, we have the news, but the other news are not the real news, because 120 is ridiculous, or I'm going to be really curious to see that report. I want to add something about water. There's a famous man in Germany, he's called Victor Schlauberger, and he discovered that the movement of a water, like a spring or a creek, is actually energizing the water. And he actually developed certain equipment, which you can buy on Amazon today, where you energize your own water. You give it that same kind of movement like a spring or a creek would have, a whirling kind of movement, and that brings a very high quality of energized water. That's what I just want to share right now. Thank you.
Mm, wonderful water. That's a great thing to continue with as well, and the UFOs, and handing straight from Germany all the way to Canada, and Mike Dallar.
Okay, so my second story has to do with a high school girl who invented color-changing sutures to detect infection in wounds. So she's won the state science fair, and she became a finalist in the national competition, and now she's trying to get a patent. She's a student at the Iowa City West School in Iowa City, and she began working on this project in October 2019. And the reason she got into this, you know, I guess as any veteran of a science fair knows, at the core of a good, successful project is a problem that you need to solve. So she had read about sutures that were coated with this conductive material that can sense the status of a wound by changing the electrical resistance. And then it sends that information to a smartphone or a computer, and doctors can see what's going on. Well, these smart sutures, they call them, they can help people in the United States where you have, you know, expensive tools like cell phones, and in a lot of developing countries, but in the developing countries where internet access isn't always there, mobile technology is not really up to speed. On the average, 11% of surgical wounds develop infection, and that compared to 2 to 4 in the United States. And so this is all what she came up with is brilliant. You know, she found that healthy human skin is naturally acidic with a pH of around 5. But when a wound becomes infected, its pH goes up to about 9. So the pH change can be detected without electronics. If anybody remembers from basic chemistry, when you do the litmus tests, well, she found out that many fruits and vegetables are natural indicators of the change in color at different pH levels. And they change color. So she found that beets changed color at perfect pH point. A bright red beet juice turns dark purple at a pH of 9, and that's perfect for an infected wound. And so she was like, okay, so beets is where it's at. Then she had to find a suture thread that would hold up to the dye. So she tested 10 different materials, including suture thread, obviously, and how they picked up the dye and whether the dye was the color of the right pH and how their thickness compared and all that kind of stuff. And after She even had to work online when this COVID thing hit. Anyway, she came up with a cotton polyester blend that she could buy and check all of the boxes. After 5 minutes under an infection-like pH, the cotton polyester thread changes from bright red to dark purple. And after 3 days, the purple fades to a light gray. So she's come up with a way that they can make this available to people anywhere, anyhow, and she's looking for to get a patent for it. So I thought that was pretty clever.
Absolutely clever and so applicable. I look forward to seeing colored bandages and threads throughout our medical systems. That's great. I appreciate that, Mike. And then, yes, onto something completely different. And yes, being a biologist, I have moved towards the nature side of things. And this one is a key favorite topic of fungi. So you may know a mushroom, but a mushroom is only a tiny bit of the story. The mushroom is the fruiting body that's often on the surface. Underneath that is an absolute massive, massive world of what's called mycelium. And mycelium you could compare to, say, the roots of a tree, but we're talking super, super fine. And then those mycelium themselves break into even smaller pieces called hyphae. And a journal article that was published this year is looking at the fungal foraging behavior of how hyphae move and explore their microspaces. Now, that's quite a specific thing. And I guess to interpret it, it's just saying they're looking to say, how does the hyphae, that's the roots of the fungi, move through the tiny spaces of soil, of bark, of leaves to get around? And is it the same in all species? And what they found was different species of hyphae, so different species of fungi, have different behaviors in their roots. And what this does is instead of competing with each other, these different types of fungi, they actually have different ways of absorbing nutrients. So like we see in the plant kingdom, when we're looking on the terrestrial surface, that's the land surface, we might see that, you know, some trees grow this way and get that sort of light, and different shrubs are adapted to the shade and they take a different part of light. So again, we're not talking about competition as much as finding a niche and knowing how to flourish in that space. Now, what they found is that the fungal hyphae are the same. So a key thing about fungal hyphae is also called the wood wide web, like the internet. But in this case, the fungal hyphae are in all of the soil, not only as themselves, just as the fungi, but attached to the roots of almost every other plant in a forest ecosystem. And even in our backyards where we have a tree, we will have fungi as an association with that tree, because these hyphae are the ones that are able to move out and absorb the nutrients at a much greater rate than plant roots do. So they live together. The fungal hyphae will take in the nutrients and give them to the plant. Now, there are parasitic fungi as well. There's damaging fungi. There's all sorts, just like humans. We come in all shapes and sizes and motivations. But in general, this paper has shown that it's not just, hey, we're a fungal hyphae, we're going to look for the nutrient-rich stuff and we're all going to go there and compete with each other and get it. It showed that different species have different ways of foraging. And it's even funny to think of that word foraging when we're talking about a microscopic thread as it moves through the soil. But when you're walking on the earth today, have a consideration for those millions and millions of miles and kilometers worth of fungal hyphae that are navigating their way through the soil spaces and bringing nutrients to the trees. And as you've heard, we've definitely gone through a very wide diversity of topics. We have time for a couple more in our closing of today's program, but let's hear again from Dr. Joyce Mollenhauer.
Hi. Sure, there were a couple more things I didn't include earlier about the water that are fun to think about and realize. They talk about the vibrant lifestyle near water. And I know Geraldine lives near water and could probably very much talk about how vibrant that is. So when you are near water and you breathe the fresh air, you get all kinds of negative ions. And I think that's fairly well known. What those negative ions do is that they allow your body to absorb oxygen. And when people don't breathe properly, effectively, we do not get oxygen to all the billions and trillions of cells in our body. So if you happen to be by water, make even a bigger effort to take deep breaths. And then other positive effects of those negative ions that you're getting because you're near water, it strengthens your immune rejuvenation. Now, those two words I hadn't seen together, but our immune system does need rejuvenating very often. So I like to remember that phrase by breathing deeply. When I'm near water to get the negative ions, I can rejuvenate my immune system. I can increase the white blood cells. I can have better sleep and happiness, and I can be relaxed. And then the other small piece that they talked about, a phrase called blue mind in quotation marks, is a meditative state that is associated with being near or in water. So next time you have the gift of being in or near water, you can say to your head, I'm in blue mind and I can meditate easily here. So that's all I wanted to share.
That's beautiful and very practical, Joyce. And I guess, as you mentioned before, even a shower, or if you can't get to water, having an image of water, and we can create that. That's wonderful. And I'd like to hand over to Trina in Denver, Colorado.
Yes, I'm going to jump off the UFO topic this time. And I found this really cool little article in Science Daily. It's sciencedaily.com. And it talks about that meditative practice and spiritual well-being may preserve cognitive functioning in aging, specifically concerning with Alzheimer's disease. And this is a new review. There's been several doctors who've been looking at it, and it finds that spiritual fitness, a new concept in medicine that centers on the psychological and spiritual well-being, along with, and they're using a little study called, or a little practice called Kirtan Kriya, and it's a simple 12-minute meditative practice. It's showing that it's reducing the risk factors and the issues around Alzheimer's disease. Now, the projections are that 152 million people worldwide could have Alzheimer's by 2050. And this particular review was in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. And they're really dealing, these doctors are dealing with a new emerging field of study called neurotheology. And they're looking at the impact that spirituality and religion and meditation, what impacts it has on the physical body and how it improves that cognitive function. So this little 12-minute exercise includes like four sounds, breathing exercises, and repetitive finger movements. It's super simple, and they're actually seeing that it's making a difference. So it's very exciting to see. We hear about meditation and well-being practices, but it's really great that now they're turning into a new field of study.
Absolutely. And again, another practical tip of how we can apply it straight away. So that's fantastic. Appreciate that, Trina. And now back to the Southern Hemisphere and Marianne in Australia.
Yeah, I thought I got excited about the UFO topic. So I thought I'd share a little story about a UFO experience that happened in Melbourne. And that was like years ago in 1966. There was a whole school and they were in their classes. There were like 200 students, there were teachers, and a couple of like unidentified flying objects, a big round silvery green objects like hovered over the school and then landed in the oval. And then after about 20 minutes, shot up into the sky and disappeared, leaving marks on the oval. And obviously back in the 60s, they didn't have cell phones, so it wasn't recorded, but it's recorded in the minds of 200 people back then. And apparently at the time, people from the military came and threatened the teachers not to talk about it, told the students not to talk about it. So no one was allowed to discuss it, even though it was obviously put in papers and things, because you could read about it. But no one could talk about it again. And now they've had reunions like 50 years later, and they're all able to recall exactly the same information as they could back then. So I thought I'd share that.
Fascinating. Yeah. It's certainly all coming together. I think there'll be a time when people will say, well, of course there's life on other planets. That we're right in that. I feel that right on the cusp now. We appreciate that. And now Germany, Rosemary.
I just recently saw a YouTube movie, and it shared, they were doing some research in your ear, in the hearing capacity of a person. And they were making some, I don't know how you call that in English, but they were measuring the vibrations and the frequency in the ear and around the brain when there were certain sounds. And what they found out by measuring then the blood and checking the blood, that the silence, when there was complete silence, the blood work was improved. The blood actually had a better immune reaction. It was, it had different components. And basically the title was Silence is Good for Your Body. And I thought that was interesting because, well, many of us are meditating and going into silence, and they actually measured that, and they proved that silence is also physically good for your body, and the vibration of silence, or so to speak, increases your blood. And also I was recently talking to someone who was at intensive virtual at Dr. Jody Spencer, and he shared that he's not wearing any mask or is not really enforcing that, because they have been proving now, they have blood work, that meditation increases the immune system very, very strongly. And when you are meditating in that room or meditating at home by yourself, you are actually increasing the immune system.
Mm. Beautiful again to have such a profound piece of information that silence is physically good for us as well. Appreciate that, Rosemary. And now we'll continue our journey around the globe with our co-host, Mike Delart in Canada.
Okay, thank you. My next story has, I don't know, Rosemary, how much you like snow, but this story might be of interest to you because they have found climate warming is causing significant snowfall increases in Europe. Climate change doesn't always manifest in the most obvious ways. It's easy to extrapolate models to show that winters are getting warmer and to forecast a virtually snow-free Europe in the future. But the most recent study showed that that might be a little too simplistic. Professor Alan Hubbard of the Arctic University of Norway in a recent paper reports a counterintuitive climactic paradox. A 50% reduction in the Arctic sea ice cover has increased open water and winter evaporation to fuel more extreme snowfall further south across Europe. So what we're finding, he says, is that the sea ice is effectively a lid on the ocean. And with its long-term reduction across the Arctic, we're seeing increased amounts of moisture entering the atmosphere during winter, which directly impacts our weather further south, causing extreme heavy snowfalls. This might seem counterintuitive, he says, but nature is complex and what happens in the Arctic doesn't always stay in the Arctic.
Wow, it certainly is a diverse set of information today and showing that we are living on a live and very interactive planet and indeed an interactive universe. So I appreciate that, Mike. And as our last story of the day, I'll go to a recent piece of news from, it's actually one of the journal articles, and it's looking at how roots and plant shoots, how do roots know to go down and how do leaves know to go up? Well, we know this as a science around for a long time of that, but they're actually re-looking at it now in terms of how do we get plants into space? So you'll know that there's, you know, much exploration of potential life and living on Mars and the moon and all sorts of things. But a key thing is, what will we eat? And people generally eat plants, and that's something that it would be good to have up there. Also, plants regulate oxygen, carbon dioxide. The plants, or the standing tall ones, as Parisha shares with us, are our equal, that as we breathe out the carbon dioxide, they breathe it in. They breathe out the oxygen, we breathe it in. So we really owe so much to our connection with the beautiful green world. And this one is just a little look at the science of how do they know what is up. So inside a leaf itself, inside the cell, like us, we have cells, plants have cells. Inside the cell, there is a small crystal. And what happens is for example, you may have known a pot plant of yours may have gone to the side, or a tree may have blown over, or a shrub, and you'll see that instead of it just continuing to grow outwards horizontally, it somehow knows that that's not up and it changes to start to grow up. What's actually happened is that crystal has moved because the cell is now in a different direction. The crystal is now pushing on a different part of the cell, and the cell then has a register that says, where that crystal is pushing is down. So then it knows to produce cell growth or elongate the cell. So that's how it bends, elongates one side of the cell and bends it around so that it has its reference point that the pressure from the crystal is down. Therefore, we can bend our cells and grow up. So what they're looking at is that's how it works on Earth. How does that work when we don't have the gravitational pull indicating to the plants that that crystal is equivalent to down? And what they basically came up with is they need to do more research. So it's interesting to know that what we're looking at here, fundamentals of plant science, is a whole new frontier when we look at it in a different space. And that's our closing for today's call. We're going to conclude our studies, and we thank you for sharing your time and energy with us. You matter and count. You always make a difference. And we look forward to being with you next week as we make that leap to greater consciousness. Have a powerful week and allow your light to shine, and always all good things